Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is the second hour of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls. In this part of Focus, we'll talk about current events in Iran and the tension that's been existing for some time now between the governments of Iran and the United States. The Bush administration says that Iran is a major concern for it. The U.S. has accused Iran of working against American interests in Iraq and, perhaps more importantly, of moving toward the development of nuclear weapons. Now, for its part, the Iranian government has said that it does not intend to develop nuclear weapons. It is interested in developing nuclear power as an energy source, and also has said in very strong terms that it will not back down and is not particularly interested in what the United States has to say. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Dariush Zahidi. He is a lecturer in political science at the University of California at Berkeley. He's also been a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University's Center for Middle Eastern Studies. His articles have appeared in journals including Middle East Policy and the Harvard Middle Eastern and Islamic Review. He's also authored two books, The Iranian Revolution Then and Now, Indicators of Regime Instability, and also another titled Iran in the New Millennium, Opportunities and Challenges. Among other things, he is involved in research looking at state building and modernization in three countries, in Turkey, Iran, and Afghanistan. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, as always, questions are welcome. That's the idea of the program here. Questions, comments from people who are listening are welcome. If you'd like to join the conversation and you're in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. The call's on us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Zahidi, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let me ask you a very basic question to begin with. To the extent that we know what the intent and the policy of the Iranian government is as far as nuclear power and weapons are concerned, as I said, the United States, their concern is that Iran is working to develop nuclear weapons. The government of Iran says, no, our interest is in developing nuclear power as an energy source, because we believe we need to diversify our sources of energy. And that seems to be where it stands. What do we know about Iran's interest in developing nuclear weapons, or in fact, whether you think that the country is indeed moving in that direction?
I think as far as the motivations of Iran is concerned, they are quite correct when they say that they are interested in developing alternative energy sources, because prior to the revolution, Iran had a population of some 35 million people. It produced about 6 million barrels of oil per day, most of which it exported. But today, the population of Iran has doubled, or more than doubled. They are producing at most 4.5 million barrels of oil per day. And they are consuming about 2 million barrels of that 4.5. So if the current trends continue, they will have nothing to export in the next 10 years or so. Now, as far as weapons are concerned, or weaponizing their nuclear program, I think that there are undoubtedly elements within the Islamic Republic who would want to retain that option. And if you develop the infrastructure for civilian purposes, then you obviously have the opportunity to weaponize it mm-hmm. at a later date. And Iran does have strategic and geopolitical considerations for pursuing the weapons route.
Let me just pick up on that last point and ask you if indeed their concern, they have security concerns, and they think for that reason that it might be important to for them to have nuclear weapons. What are their concerns? Who does Iran feel threatened by that they would feel that it would be necessary for them to have nuclear weapons as part of their defense structure?
Iran, as you know, lives in a very dangerous neighborhood. It is surrounded by neighbors which do have nuclear capability. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. Israel has nuclear weapons, and Israel is viewed as Iran's strategic rival in this area. India has nuclear weapons. Russia has nuclear weapons. And also, increasingly, this regime feels that it is becoming encircled by the United States, that in the aftermath of the overthrow of the Taliban in Afghanistan and the Ba'ath Party in Iraq, the United States is present in both Iraq and in Afghanistan. And the United States is also present, of course, in the Persian Gulf region. There is a great dispute between Iranians and Arabs as to how one should refer to this body of water. The Iranians, of course, believe that it should be called the Persian Gulf. The Arabs maintain that it should be the Arabian Gulf. But increasingly, it looks neither Arab nor Persian, but it has come to resemble an American lake, with the American Fifth Fleet dominating the waters of the Persian Gulf. So, to the extent that the Iranian ruling elites may be interested in acquiring nuclear capability, I think they would like to have this capability as a deterrent against any type of intervention in Iran. Mm-hmm. In other words, emulate the example of North Korea. They see that one of the members of President Bush's axis of evil, Iraq, was invaded and its regime was overthrown by the United States. Iraq did not possess nuclear weapons. They also look at what happened to North Korea and they draw the appropriate lessons. I think, therefore, that they want to emulate the example of North Korea, if they are indeed interested in having nuclear weapons. In other words, have the nuclear option in order to preempt a preemption.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the fact that within Iran there are people who feel that it would be important for them in order to meet their energy needs and also continue to be able to export oil for them to have, as a source of energy, have nuclear power. And, of course, then the concern is that if you have the technology to produce the fuel for a nuclear reactor, then that also means that if you wanted to, you have the technology to produce fissionable material that you could use to make a bomb. And that while there might not be a lot of people now within Iran who would be interested in taking it to that point, that it's certainly possible once you have the technology to do that. So here, I guess one of the things that I'm wondering is within Iran, not only within the government, but, you know, let's say within within people who were engaged in politics in Iran, whether there would be a strong interest in, if not developing weapons, at least having that capability for a strategic sense, or to what extent Iran is reacting to the rest of the world, the United States particularly, and when the United States says, or the rest of the world says to Iran, we don't want you to have the capacity to develop nuclear weapons, is some of the response on the Iranian side merely a matter of pride, in a sense, and not wanting to appear to cave into international pressure, for them to be able to say, well, this is our country and we're going to do what we think is right for Iran. And if the rest of the world doesn't like it, that's tough. I mean, I wonder to what extent it is just on the Iranian side a response to outside pressure.
Well, I think that the government of Iran has certainly done its best to turn this issue into an issue of national pride. And to some extent, I think that they've succeeded. And the primary argument is that Iran, as a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, has the right, has the inalienable right to master the nuclear fuel cycle, and that the United States is preventing Iran from doing so for its own purposes. So, yes, I think it has become an issue of national pride, and as you pointed out, the Iranian government has consistently maintained that it is not interested in weaponizing its program. Mm-hmm. It simply wants to have nuclear technology for civilian purposes.
Are there people in Iran, again, either within government or people we might call elites, I guess, without meaning to give that any negative connotation, who believe that the very kind of confrontational approach that the current government, led by Mr. Ahmadinejad, has taken is a mistake?
Yes, I think so. The regime in Iran is very much fractured and fragmented, and you have competing factions as well as competing centers of power. And many of these factions are not happy with the performance of Mr. Ahmadinejad. Ahmadinejad's rhetorical utterances, in particular, in denying the Holocaust and threatening to wipe Israel off the map and so forth. I think these utterances have certainly enabled the United States and the EU and the international community to move much more rapidly on Iran's nuclear issue. Mm-hmm. So yes, there are definitely differences within the regime. I think all of the factions are united in the opinion that Iran should be able to possess nuclear technology, definitely for civilian purposes, and also to develop the infrastructure in case the need arises for weaponizing the program. But they don't think probably that Ahmadinejad has acted wisely in terms of what he's been saying.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. And also, let me again introduce the guest for this hour, Dariush Zahidi. He's a lecturer in political science at the University of California at Berkeley. And we're talking here about Iran, politics in Iran, and this continuing sort of tension involving particularly Iran and the governments of Iran and the United States. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here ready to go. The first is in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hello. As you stated, Iran has stated they're not interested in producing nuclear weapons. If that is so, then why don't they process their fuel through Russia to safeguard the possibility of them manufacturing fissionable material into nuclear weapons?
Thank you. They say that they have the right to enrich uranium in their own country, and because they are a signatory to the NPT, they have the right to do that. But nonetheless, they have been negotiating with the Russians, and I think they came close to agreeing on a deal whereby Iran would enrich minimum and limited amounts of uranium inside its own territory and then send the rest of it to Russia so that it would be further enriched in Russia. However, the United States and the EU, and I think eventually also Russia, came out against this agreement, and therefore it fell through. And that's where the issue stands now. As I said, it's become somewhat of a issue of national pride for Iran, and the Iranian government, after arguing so vehemently for so long that they do have the inalienable right to enrich uranium, will find it very difficult to abandon the enrichment program altogether. So they wanted essentially to have a face-saving gesture. And unfortunately, it hasn't worked out yet.
I don't see how the international community can let the ironies build fissionable materials into potential weapons, especially given the leader's statement to wipe off Israel off the map. Do you see where this is headed? Do you have any feelings about what's going to happen?
I think now Iran's nuclear dossier has been referred to the Security Council, and the Europeans and the United States will try to convince the Security Council to impose sanctions on Iran. However, I don't think that the imposition of meaningful sanctions on Iran are likely, because both Russia and China, which have the veto power in the Council, are likely to veto any meaningful sanctions, and by that I mean imposition of sanctions on Iranian oil and gas, which I think are the only type of sanctions which would really hurt the Iranian government and have the potential of bringing it to its knees. Other types of sanctions are likely to be symbolic. And although they could also be painful, but most of the pain will be felt by the Iranian people and not by the Iranian government. So long as the government is capable of selling its oil, it would receive between $50 to $60 billion a year, and it would manage to continue and sustain its hold on power. So I don't think that the Security Council would be able to impose meaningful sanctions on Iran. And then the EU and the U.S. may decide to impose their own sanctions. But so long as Iran is capable of trading with Asia, I don't think those sanctions would really hurt the government either. They may create difficulties, definitely, but they will not prompt the government to change its policy. I think if sanctions don't work, then the issue of strategic strikes may come to be considered. But again, strategic strikes are also extremely problematic when it comes to Iran.
Yes. Well, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Just for a moment here, you know, we have mentioned a couple of times, made reference a couple of times to these very inflammatory remarks that the Iranian president, Mr. Ahmadinejad, made about Israel, about how it should be wiped off the map, questioning whether the Holocaust happened or not. And that may indeed be a true indication of what he believes. But I also have read some people who are suggesting that those remarks were really intended, while they were denounced by people outside of Iran, were really intended for internal consumption, and that were a reflection of the fact that he has not been able to follow through on the kinds of promises that he made to improve the lives of poor and disadvantaged Iranians that he made and that actually got him elected. He hasn't really done very much in that time. And so the analysis goes that what he's trying to do is distract people from the fact that things are the economy in Iran is not doing particularly well. And that if he can rally people around, you know, to the cause of nationalism in Iran, to get everybody to say, well, we're all Iranians, we're all going to stick together. And that might, in fact, take their minds off the fact that in other respects, life in Iran is perhaps not what it should be, or not maybe what he said that it would be. Is that the kind of analysis, do you think, that makes sense?
To some extent, although he's been in power for only the past 6 months, and realistically there isn't much that he could do in 6 months.
Mm.
But yes, it could be designed to deflect attention from his shortcomings and incapabilities. But at the same time, I think more importantly, it is designed to further isolate Iran internationally. I think Ahmadinejad, as you correctly point out, is a populist, and the faction from which he comes and to which he is beholden is the most extremist faction in Iran, and it is the faction which controls significant elements of Iran's coercive apparatus. So that he recognizes that the more isolated the country becomes, the more security issues come to dominate debates internally and externally, the more favorable it will be for his faction. So it's a means by which he's trying to enhance his own status as well as the status of the faction to which he is beholden in Iran. I talked about strategic strikes earlier. I think the security faction in Iran probably welcomes strategic strikes as a means of further consolidating its hold on power, rallying the people behind the flag, definitely, and extinguishing the remnants of Iran's civil society. Because if there are strategic strikes, then the other factions would also have to close ranks behind the security faction.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with some other callers. We have someone in here locally in Champaign County. They're next. Line two. Hello.
Hi. I wanted you to comment on some of the perhaps intricacies of the IEA referral. A while back, when it was originally taken up, there had to be some protocols developed, and there was a battle over some of the language, and it was seen as a strategic defeat for the U.S. to have, and they attributed it to Egypt's intransigence, but I think there might have been other countries involved, to add the language that it would call for some efforts to denuclearize the entire region. Now, people don't remember that the Gulf War treaty, also UN accords that settled that or ended it anyway, called for efforts to that event anyway. I thought that since they were fighting so hard to have that language kept out, that once it was in, it might make a difference. But it doesn't seem to have. No one seems to be commenting on it in the press here. I assume the international press and other places are talking about it. Another thing that happened with the IEA is that this latest referral came without a recommendation for any particular action, and I gather that was also something that was fought over. This is in the context of also that the referral was delayed to the month of March, when the U.S. had the presidency of the Security Council in February with Bolton, and they sort of kicked it past him in a manner of speaking. So there seems to be there have been some diplomatic defeats in the U.S. push for whatever they want. I have another question, but maybe that's enough to, and if I could have that, I'd appreciate it. But could you comment on any of those?
Sure. I don't think they're diplomatic defeats per se, but the U.S. has had to compromise in order to get the Russians, the Chinese, and the Europeans behind it. You're absolutely right. They delayed referring the nuclear dossier to the Security Council by 1 month in order to give diplomacy a further chance. And during this one-month period, Iran and Russia were negotiating over the deal for having Iranian uranium enriched on Russian territory, to which we alluded earlier. And as I indicated earlier, there are divisions and fragmentations within the Security Council. And up to now, the Security Council has not even been able to reach a consensus as to how it should rebuke Iran. The wording of the statement, which is to be issued by the Security Council, and at this point they're just simply talking about issuing a statement calling on Iran to collaborate further with the IAEA and sending the dossier back to the IAEA. But even here, they're having difficulties coming up with a statement which would be minimally acceptable to all of the members of the Security Council, which is not a particularly good sign as far as the U.S. is concerned. Indicates that there isn't much consensus, and that when it comes to the issue of sanctions, I don't think that either Russia or China are likely to budge for their own interests and reasons.
There was a the other points I wanted to get you to comment on were the fact that the EU has had supposedly a fairly successful previous agreement that I believe included no reprocessing on Iranian soil. I'm not actually sure what all of the, but included the fact that the EU would have to guarantee, make some kind of security guarantee, that is, obviate any attacks, military attacks from the U.S. or and or Israel. More recently, the Russian negotiation, as you talked about, was almost seemed to be almost successful, and included a one particular constellation of possibilities that the industrial refinement of uranium, fissionable uranium, would happen in Russia, but that the Iranians would keep the some kind of limited laboratory to do small-scale just sort of research, I assume, using lasers to separate and whatever else they were wanting to do to try to. But that was, initially it seemed like the Russians were going to offer that, and it was shot down by the EU almost immediately. And to my mind, given the range of possibilities and the fact that that would include inspections, and that actually the sophistication of some technical means, obviously they're not absolutely infallible, but the idea that industrial refinement takes a lot of energy and that the U.S. can monitor that kind of thing fairly well, even without on-site inspections. Anyway, I just thought that it seemed that was. Do you know anything about what was going on with that? Well, how that was dismissed? It seems that the EU will not step out and actually assert itself, and that means that I feel rather grim about it, because it seems to be that the U.S. will just wait until it can unleash the dogs of war, which I think would be terribly regional, and it would also make Iraq even more of a bloodbath than it is now.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Not just EU, but also the United States. Both the EU and the United States maintain that Iran should suspend enrichment, period, for a long period of time in order to enhance the confidence of the international community. And they say that because Iran lied about its nuclear program or concealed its nuclear program for 18 years, it therefore forfeited its rights to enrichment of uranium. But you're right. It appeared that Russia and Iran were about to reach a compromise so that Iran would be able to enrich limited amounts of uranium for research and development. The rest of it would be sent to Russia to be enriched for industrial purposes. But that deal fell through after the Russian foreign minister came here to the United States and had a meeting with Condoleezza Rice.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. I would just like to introduce once again the guest with this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Dariush Zahidi. He's a lecturer in political science at the University of California, Berkeley. We're talking about Iran, politics in Iran, and the current tension surrounding Iran and its nuclear program. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We have some others here. Next, we'll go to a caller in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I have a quick question. Could you tell me, it seems to me, just my casual reading of the situation, that for the last 50 years or so, the U.S. has been quite antagonistic toward Iran. I don't see anything that, personally, I haven't read anything that seems to indicate anything at all different, you know, from the overthrow of Mossadegh to their choosing Iraq over Iran in their war. I was wondering if you had anything that you could point to anything where the U.S. has been anything but antagonistic, any kind of peace failures, anything at all, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, certainly in the aftermath of the Iranian Revolution and after the seizing of the hostages, the two countries have been extremely antagonistic towards one another. As you correctly point out, and during the Iran-Iraq War, the United States backed Iraq, and it moved closer to the side of Saddam Hussein as the war progressed, to the extent that towards the end of this war, the U.S. actually almost fought directly on the side of Iraq. During the Clinton administration, in the second term of Clinton, the two sides began to talk to each other. And when Khatami was the president of Iran, he made some overtures to the U.S. But you're right, nothing much came of these overtures, and the general relationship between the two countries has been, for the most part, highly antagonistic, and it has deteriorated in recent years. The Iranian regime is definitely worried and concerned, above all, with its survival. And I think they believe that the best way to guard against regime change from without is the possession of nuclear capability. And if this is true, then the best way of handling the Iranian nuclear crisis would be through direct face-to-face negotiations between Iran and the United States. In other words, if it's true that Iran is interested in nuclear capability because it wants to preempt an American intervention, then it stands to reason that it should negotiate with the U.S. and not with the European trio or with Russia or with China. And security guarantees from the United States probably could go a long way towards allaying the fears and concerns of the Iranian ruling elite.
Well, again, I hope they get to the question in the call. Let's go on to another caller. This is someone in Champaign, and it's line three. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Earlier, the issue of domestic considerations in Iran were brought up as a motivation for you know, some of the positions that the Iranian government is taking, but I would contend that the Bush administration uses this and in fact, the invasion of Iraq very much for domestic political reasons, and that, you know, they just a lot of this is a way of making people afraid of everything so that they'll keep voting for the Bush administration, keep doing everything the Bush administration wants, keep the Republicans in power. I can't remember if it was Roosevelt or Churchill who said, you know, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. It seems like the Bush administration's message is be afraid, be very afraid. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, you know, what your take on that is.
Well, it could be, definitely. And there are certain elements within the administration who have always been very interested in Iran. Elements within the administration or elements closely tied to the administration. I think shortly after the collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq, I believe it was Richard Perle who stated that it's good to go to Baghdad, but real men want to go to Tehran. And one has to wonder why real men want to go to Tehran. And I believe that I have a notion as to why real men want to go to Tehran, because Iran is truly the strategic prize in the Middle East, definitely in the Persian Gulf region. It has the longest coastline along the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea, and it is the only country which is uniquely positioned to connect the Persian Gulf to the Caspian Basin. And with 70% of the petroleum resources of the world contained within the periphery of the Gulf, and the Caspian Basin also emerging as a significant source of oil and gas, I think it's alluring and lucrative to be in Tehran. But there are obviously impediments and difficulties involved with going to Tehran. I think the question of invading Iran is off the books, because Iran is three times the size of Iraq. It has three times the population of Iraq, and it is not an artificial entity. It's one of the few countries in the region, or in the world actually, which is not artificial. It's one of the oldest civilizations in the world. And at the moment, of course, the United States is overstretched militarily, financially, and diplomatically.
Well, I would say that if the Bush administration has done nothing else, they've certainly exposed the limits of American military power. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call.
There are limits, definitely, when it comes to invading Iran. But I don't think not even neocons are talking about launching a full-scale invasion of Iran. But the issue of strategic strikes is a different one. And unfortunately, I think that it could become or come to be viewed as a more viable option if the crisis continues and the Security Council proves incapable of doing much. And then I think as election time approaches here, there may be some pressure on the administration to do something.
If something like that should happen, you know, there has also been some pretty tough talk on the Iranian side about how they would respond. If something like that should happen, what sort of a stick, so to speak, does Iran have if it wanted to respond? I mean, other than perhaps limiting oil exports, what could the Iranians do?
I think the Iranians can do plenty. Ironically, because of the ouster of the Taliban and Saddam Hussein's regime, Iran's geopolitical and strategic situation has become enhanced. And they obviously are in a position to create mischief both in Iraq and in Afghanistan. In Iraq, they have and they control many cards. And many elements in Iraq are closely aligned with Iran. They were supported by the Iranians during the time of Saddam Hussein. And I think Iranian security forces and intelligence forces have definitely infiltrated Iraq, and they are capable of launching another insurgency or contributing to the current ongoing insurgency. So if you think what's going on in Iraq today, with Iraq being in incipient stages of a civil war, then after strategic strikes on Iran, I think the situation in Iraq is likely to get much, much worse. Mm-hmm. Iran also has some influence in Afghanistan, particularly in the western province of Herat, bordering on Iran. Iran has 700 miles of common borders with Afghanistan, and it could also make life difficult for the United States in Afghanistan. Iran also has some cards, significant cards, to play in the Persian Gulf region, wherever there are Shias, either Shia majorities or Shia minorities. Notably in Bahrain, where you have a Shia majority and a Sunni-dominated regime. Bahrain is also the country where America's Fifth Fleet is stationed in the Gulf. There are also some Shias in Kuwait, but much more importantly, there are also Shias in Saudi Arabia. There is a Shia minority which lives in the sensitive eastern province of the Saudi kingdom, the Al-Hasa province. And the significance of the Al-Hasa province is that it is in Al-Hasa where most of Saudi Arabia's oil installations and facilities are located. The Shias in Saudi Arabia have perennially and traditionally been discriminated against, and they've been marginalized. And I think that should Iran wanted to do so, it could agitate in that area. And I wonder what will happen to the price of oil if a couple of oil wells in the Al-Hasa province are blown up. The Iranians can also retaliate using Hezbollah in Lebanon. And Iran helped to establish Hezbollah in 1982, and it has close and intimate ties with certain elements within Hezbollah, at least. And all indications are that the influence of Hezbollah in Lebanon is growing rather than diminishing. So, and Hezbollah is viewed by many analysts as having a wider global reach than even Al-Qaeda. So Iran definitely is in a position to retaliate.
I certainly was going to bring up the subject of Lebanon, as I have been reading some suggestion recently that people think that indeed because the Lebanese pushed the Syrians out, after the assassination of Rafiq Hariri, a former prime minister, and people in Lebanon felt that Syria had something to do with that. So they managed to get they pushed the Syrians out. That leaves a significant power vacuum, and there is the opportunity of Iran to exercise even greater influence through Hezbollah, which an organization that it has been providing support for a long time, a Shiite group.
Absolutely. Hezbollah is a Shiite political grouping in Lebanon, and it has a lot of influence amongst the Shias of Lebanon, especially those who live in the south of Lebanon. And as you correctly point out, since Syria left Lebanon, I think the position of Iran has become enhanced. It has not become diminished, because before that time, Syria played a restraining role, but now it's no longer there to do so, as far as Iranian influence, at least in Lebanon, was concerned.
Yeah. Well, we have about 5 minutes. We have some other callers. I'd like to try to include one or two, whatever we can do. We'll go to the next person in line, and this, I believe, is someone in Champaign, and that would be line number one. Hello.
Yes. I'm interested in issues of the fragility of the American empire and blowback implied, of course, with the apparent strengthening of the Shia in the Middle East, in the process of attacking Iraq and so forth. And also, and I hope you could speak to that, it may be, even if, let's say, a Democrat wins in 2008, what the hopes are and what the dismaying aspects are of the blowback that one imagines could and probably will occur, given what's happened so far and the chaos in Iraq and so forth. And I'm not sure listeners realize the extent to which, for a country like Iran, the United States has, what, throughout the world, and I think of roughly 140 countries, roughly 800 bases of one sort or another, and roughly 13, I think, are being built in Iraq right now. So I wish you could speak to what the Iranian perspective is on this, as well as other Arabic and Persian states of the region with regard to the apparent fragility, in spite of the seeming dominance of the American empire, but its fragility in this process and how they might take advantage of that. The other thing I wanted to speak to was, I find something very ironic that the American government is speaking on the one hand to India in glowing terms about, you know, even their nuclear prospects in cooperation and praising them for being a democracy, while at the same time not offering it to Pakistan, but praising Pakistan as well, when India, of course, didn't sign the Non-Proliferation Act and so on. So anyway, I'll look forward to your comments.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Certainly the Indian case, I think a lot of people have raised that and said that this is the administration is undercutting itself, its own policy, by taking these two very different sorts of positions, the one it takes recently has taken as far as India is concerned, and the other as far as Iran is concerned.
Absolutely. And the Iranians, of course, are gleeful, and they can point to what they view as American hypocrisy and duplicity in the manner in which they have dealt with India in particular and Israel on the one hand, and the manner in which they deal with Iran on the other. And also Pakistan. Pakistan is not a signatory to the NPT, and they have developed nuclear weapons, and they're close allies of the United States, although they're not being rewarded to the same extent as India. But nonetheless, the United States does not seem to be particularly concerned about Pakistan.
Anything else that you would say in response to the caller's comments?
I would say that there is a great and grave concern in the region that, in large part because of the actions of the United States, the Shias are becoming empowered, yes. And we have to remember that a couple of months ago, the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia, Prince Saud al-Faisal, said that the United States is handing Iraq over to Iran. And people have begun to talk about a Shia triangle. Actually, the king of Jordan, King Abdullah, recently talked about the Shia triangle, including Iran, Iraq, Syria, and then moving on to Lebanon. Yes, Shias are becoming further empowered, and it is true, in large measure because of the actions of the United States. The caller referred to it as blowback, which has to do with the unintended consequences of American foreign policy.
Well, let's see if we can get at least one more caller here, and that would be line number two, someone on a cell phone. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
First of all, an excellent program. It certainly makes driving plans between Chicago and Rockford a lot more enjoyable on this boring road. A couple of comments. A call or two ago made the comment that I think the professor, who is most interesting, maybe failed to note about the hostility between Iran and the U.S. We have to remember the current regime or its progenitor kept the American consulate and American hostages in captivity for a year, and that's unprecedented. We didn't even do that to the German or Japanese envoys on the eve of World War II. So the hostility is not just U.S. generated. But more importantly, there was a comment the professor made earlier that I did want to, that I think is the subject of perhaps another show. Your guest correctly stated, it seems to me, that the current Ahmadinejad was talking about Holocaust denial, obliterating Israel, taking on the West for public consumption. But, and I think this is a subject for another show, would the professor comment about the kind of news I bet that is portrayed to the Middle East especially by the state-owned media. My satellite has allowed me, I've been watching Arab news for the last 2 years, and I'm not talking Al Jazeera. They are moderate compared to the state-run news consistently portrayed by Iran and Syria especially. And my sense is that the kind of hatred and religious hatred that is presented in the Arab news media into Syria and Iran especially, it's not like Joseph Goebbels. It's clever and subtle. I think he reflects what the people in fact think about the West and Israel. And I'll let the professor comment instead of going on.
I think it's an interesting question. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time. I could probably give you about 30 seconds, and I'm sorry to say, to make some response, Dr. Zahidi, but please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I think you're generally correct. This is definitely the case as far as the state media is concerned, not just in Iran, but also in much of the Arab world. But we have to remember that Iran is not an Arab country. And ironically, most of the people in Iran do not, I think, harbor the same sentiments which are being echoed by Ahmadinejad. Actually, the irony is that Iran is probably the only country in the Middle East next to Israel in which most of the people do not harbor anti-American sentiments. To the contrary. They don't harbor anti-American sentiments, one, because Iranians are not Arabs, and although they are perturbed by what's going on in the occupied territories, the issue of Palestine is not as near and dear to their hearts as it is to the hearts of the Arabs. Also, unlike many of the Arab regimes, the Islamic government in Iran has not been beholden to the United States. You can accuse the mullahs of many things, but being beholden to the United States is not one of them. And we also have to remember that Iran fought a 8-year bitter, bloody war with Iraq, and most Iranians were delighted when American forces overthrew the regime of Saddam Hussein. There was no love lost between Iran and Saddam, or the Ba'ath Party in particular. But Ahmadinejad represents a very small fraction of the Iranian population.
We're going to have to stop there. My apologies. We simply have come to the end of the time. Dr. Zahidi, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much, sir.
Our guest, Darish Zahidi, he is a lecturer in political science at the University of California, Berkeley.